A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
What are you doing, detective? What are you doing talking to my client without me present? You sneaky Pete.
Lose! I don't lose! I win! I win! I'm a lawyer! That's my job! That's what I do!
Hello, everybody. This is Alex Barnett. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm joined in the booth today by Ndidi Arigi. Say hello.
Hey, everybody.
Ndidi joins me for this special Thanksgiving episode 62 of the Comedians at Law podcast. We're really excited to be here on the holidays, not spending time with our respective families.
This is way better.
Yeah, undoubtedly. No, we have a great episode coming up, and we're really happy to have Ndidi in the booth for the first time. She was interviewed a couple episodes back, but she has determined that she wants to step up her game and be a co-host. So here we have her in the booth this week. Couple things. So indeed, we've got a couple of big events on the near-term horizon for Comedians at Law. I know you're going to be part of them. We just had the big event at White Plains Performing Arts Center that you missed, but we have a couple of holiday parties in town in New York that I know you're going to be performing at.
Yep, that's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and then in January, as people may know, we're going to be down in Tennessee performing at Vanderbilt Law School, and we're also looks like going to be performing for the Augusta Bar Association. So those are two big things to put on your calendars. And, it looks like we're also going to be getting some, gigs in New York, New Jersey metro area in January and February. So, and people looking to see Ndidi perform, you can see her there. You got anything else coming up?
I think that's really it. The holiday parties I'm excited about, cause it's always fun to see people when they let their hair down, shall we say.
That's right.
And lots of stuff coming up next year, beginning of the next year.
That's right. That's right. So for those of you who have bar associations or SBA groups or law firms that you're looking to get entertainment for this holiday season, even though the time is short, definitely reach out to us. We do have a few dates still left on our calendar, and we have a lot of very humorous comedians at law available to perform. So give us a shout or contact us on email at info@comediansatlaw.com or Twitter @comediansatlaw. All right, well, let's turn to the news, Ndidi. How about that?
Sounds good.
Since when has the paragon of investigative journalism allowed lawyers to determine the news content?
Okay, this week, Ndidi, we have three big stories. I know you were chomping at the bit to sink your teeth into these, so let's get right into them. The first story comes out of the world of law school, and this involves basically what above the law terms the law school version of Black Friday. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what's happening here?
Yeah, so apparently some law schools are starting to try to give, shall we call it a discount, to certain students. So they use the example of Penn State, which was giving pretty much like a 50% tuition credit back to students. So instead of actually giving you 50% off, and or lowering the cost of tuition, they're basically saying that you get, if you're a Pennsylvania resident and you go to Penn State Law, then you can get a tuition reduction. Which, I mean, I have my thoughts on it. I kind of want to hear what you think about it, Alex.
Right.
First,
well, let me ask you this. So first of all, why wouldn't they just say, you know, tuition is X, and if you live in Pennsylvania, we'll do X minus 50%. Why wouldn't they just come out with a reduction right on the front of it?
Exactly. Well, that's the thing, is that, you know, I think that they're still trying to sort of put out this, you know, we are worth this, I think it's about $41,000 for the tuition. This is what we're worth. This is what we are, you should be paying for this education.
I see. So it's we're worth this, but out of the, you know, we still have a Cadillac or Mercedes, but out of the goodness of our heart, we're going to knock 50. This is like a used car sale. We're going to knock 50% off because you guys are Pennsylvania residents. I got it.
Right. Except what's interesting is that, you know, all the law schools have really been hit very, very hard by just declining applications. And
where'd you go to law school, by the way?
I went to NYU.
How hard have they been hit?
You know, I'm not exactly sure, but
exactly.
I know that overall, all law schools have been hit. I mean,
really?
I'm sure the ones that are in the top 10, let's say, they're not feeling it that much, especially because they were probably getting way more applications that they could take when things were good.
I'm assuming
that they're still doing pretty okay.
Yeah, I think the top 10 law schools, like the one you went to, are like the top 1% of earners in the United States. In other words,
right. They're
not feeling any pain. They're
right. Sitting
down to a turkey dinner with gold-plated dinnerware. They're having a blast. The rest of us...
Paid for by student tuition.
Right, paid for by student tuition. Very good point. The rest of the law schools are sitting there like the other 99% in old... They're like homeless. They're occupying Wall Street. They've got white people dreadlocks. They haven't bathed in like a week and a half.
We call those matlocks.
Matlocks. That's very good. Oh, that's a good... That's a nice coinage.
Thanks.
That's a first here on...
I didn't coin it, but I am saying it for the first time.
I like it. For the Comedians Law, first time. You heard it here. Matlocks. So I think like the University of, you know, San Luis Obispo Law School. I'm just using that. I don't know if it exists. They're like sleeping in a sleeping bag on the street.
Right.
Right. But NYU Law School is like, hey, I'm full. I had too many pieces of stuffing.
I mean, I think you were hitting the nail on the head because, honestly, those years when, you know, the NYUs and the Columbias and Harvard, when they were getting, you know, hundreds of thousands of applications and they're letting in, you know, two people, those years, I think, are pretty much gone for everyone else. Now, for those top 10, yeah, they're still doing great, but folks like Penn State, which is not a bad law school, it's a good law school, but I think that they're really suffering, and then all of the drama with their undergrad, all the Sandusky stuff that kind of, you know, made their school.
Oh, right, the Sandusky stuff.
Well, yeah, all that stuff is kind of, you know, the varnish is a little bit worn on their school, and so I think that all of that is affecting it, but it still seems a little bit off the mark to me because they're not actually lowering the tuition. They're just saying, oh, if you live here in Pennsylvania, we'll give you a tuition credit.
Right.
But we still want everybody else to pay $41,000.
Which means it's there's no rules to it. It's a very capricious. We'll give you money off, but we won't give you money off. Let me ask you this, because you were a business litigator before getting into comedy. How does this smell to you? Does this smell like a bait and switch? Does this smell like it's got some kind of unfair, deceptive trade practice taint to it?
Well, Alex, I was actually an M&A lawyer, and so...
Oh, so you don't know what the hell you're talking about. I'll handle this one.
Well, I was going to propose that some of these law schools should think about doing some mergers and acquisitions and sort of grow themselves rather than... I mean, there are law schools there's all sorts of law schools. Just they're popping up all the time, and especially when things were good, they were popping up all the time, and I feel like we don't really need so many of them. You know, that's also a big part of it.
Well, that's an interesting point. Like, what if there were a for-profit law school that was unaccredited, but they had a lot of cash on hand?
Right.
What if they tried to do a leveraged buyout or a hostile takeover of like Harvard Law, just gobble up the biggest fish in the pond? Right.
I think that would be a great idea. I mean, I feel like if some of these law schools that were sort of hoity-toity were taken over by some of the upstarts that are, you know, really gunning and really are student-focused and about the new environment that students find themselves in and not living in this, you know, early 2000 world where there's a wonderful tech bubble and everybody's going to make, you know, $1 billion being the lawyer for Google. If some of those schools were able to kind of get in there, you know, and get that cachet of a Harvard, let's say, it'd be interesting to see what would happen.
Right. Well, so let me ask you this. What if what happens is what happened in the airline industry where there's so many mergers that you wind up with like basically two or three mega-sized competitors. So now we have like Harvard, Yale, Stanford on one hand, and then like NYU, Penn, Columbia on the other, and that's it.
Right.
They've gobbled up everybody, and they're just giant law schools with like 50,000 students apiece.
Well, you know what it would be like then, Alex? This would be like the Nigerian law school, you know, which is the one law school in the entire country, the American law school.
Right. For those of you,
United States law school, and everybody who wanted to be a lawyer would just go there.
For those of you who haven't listened to the podcast before, and particularly the episode in which Ndidi was interviewed, she is Nigerian. She did not go to the Nigerian law school. However, she does... She does affirm and attest that there is such an entity in Nigeria. it has a monopoly on the legal market because it is the law school.
But I mean, you know, all jokes aside, I do think that there's something to be said for sort of a way that some of these law school rankings that have really come to dominate how students choose where they're going to go and, you know, how employers look at you, and just it affects so many things. When that's removed, you know, you have just sort of a merit-based system where people are really judged on, oh, not that you went to Columbia or you went to Harvard, but you were the first in your class at the United States Law School, you know, and
right.
you were the person who was,
right.
you know, you're the best of the best. And in the circumstances that we have it now, I mean, going back to the whole tuition thing, there was a point where I felt like tuition just couldn't go up any higher. You know, when I went to law school, I think it was maybe 30,000, and I was like, whoa, this is crazy.
So now it's reached sort of a ceiling, it seems. Well, look, we have to make our way to the next story, but let's get a final word from you on this. So what do you think of this practice that you don't reduce tuition, you keep it at a high, but then you give breaks to certain people based on geography or what have you? What do you think, good or bad?
Look, they should go ahead and keep it however they want it, because, you know, it's a free country. But I do think that they should be conscious of the fact that soon they're going to just keep getting less and less applications, and then you're going to have to maybe just cut the prices completely for everybody, which is what I think they really should do now. If they were forward-thinking, they should go ahead and cut the tuition for everyone and really try to build up, you know, their cachet based on the fact that we're delivering, you know, something that students can really use at a non-exorbitant price.
Okay, so that's it. So if there's somebody out there involved with a law school who's engaged in this practice of cutting tuition for certain people, tweet to us at comedians at law. We have to make our way to the next story. So here we go, Indy. This is a more serious one, but no less important, and probably more important. There's a story coming out of Washington that the law that limits or bans plastic guns is set to expire, and there's concern that if it's not renewed, basically the premise or the plot line of In the Line of Fire is going to come to pass, that terrorists will be sneaking plastic guns into wherever.
I totally remember that movie, too, which was kind of amazing when I was reading it, because it seemed so futuristic at the time, and now it's a reality.
Right. So tell us a little bit more about what's happening here.
Well, basically, there has been a law that's been on the books and it's been renewed for the past 25 years. I believe it was 1988 when it was first passed, that bans guns that can't be detected by, you know, electronic scanners like the types you would have at an airport. And this law is coming up. I believe the deadline is in a week, and it needs to be renewed again. But there have been some issues getting the law renewed in Congress, mostly having to do with some folks saying, well, you know, the folks who are sort of against, who want gun control are going to try to use this to push other things. And then other ones are saying that the folks who do want gun control are saying, look, this should not be something that we're arguing about. This is something that everybody should get behind.
Right, right. What's your feeling about this? Do you think there should be more plastic guns on the streets?
Plastic guns for everyone. Look, I don't have an issue with plastic guns. I have an issue with someone having a plastic gun in a place where there are children, or someone having a plastic gun in a place where, you know, you're on a plane. I don't want someone being able to carry a plastic gun onto a plane and not being able to, you know, that's not being sort of caught by the security software. I would like it if you had a situation where that type of gun could be detected, you know. And for me, it's very tough to try to sort of stop technology. I mean, you're not going to stop it. So what's more important is to try to figure out a way for folks to, actually detect this type of technology.
So what do we think? So we should have, like, strip searches for everybody, no matter where you go? Like, if you're on the way to, if you're going to a bar, like a nightclub, let's say, and your woman's dressed up really well, and the bouncer outside's like, look, lady, you're going to have to strip because you might have a plastic gun on you.
I doubt we're going to be able to do the whole strip search thing, because we couldn't even get the body scanners through. People were not into the body scanners, you know? And that I was totally fine with. I was fine with the body scanners. I felt like you could get a completely, a clear idea of what somebody had on them without seeing sort of their privates, let's say. And people had a problem with that. A lot of people hated them, and TSA took them away. So I don't think that there's going to be any sort of search that's going to be able to really make a difference. I think it's going to have to be some other sort of technology that can detect maybe the types of material that these guns are made of.
What if people are getting on airlines or whatever, or going to a nightclub, you expose them to great heat, and if they started to melt, you could say, oh, well, you must have a plastic gun on you because you're melting.
You sound like the Salem witch press where they're like, we're going to burn you at the stake. If you burn, you are not a witch.
Right. If you don't burn,
you are a witch.
Right. Well, no, but let me put it this way. I'll put my opinion out there. I have no problem with plastic guns as long as they're not capable of shooting anything out of them.
Other
than water. Once you go past the water gun, I think that we need to start banning. And I'm not even talking about the things that shoot like lawn darts. There's no reason to have a plastic gun other than if you're trying to evade security.
Right. That's what I think, too. I mean, I don't see any other reason to have it except that it's not going to be detected by the authorities.
I mean, the NRA can't come in here and say, well, hunters, you know, that's always the argument. Well, hunters, right, or self-defense. Well, I'm sorry, but you don't need to hunt a deer with a plastic concealable, you know, John Malkovich pistol. And for self-defense, I mean, if a plastic gun, you might as well have like a baseball bat at that point because this thing is going to corrode over time. And this is like a one-shot deal where you're really trying to do John Malkovich, you know.
I do feel like people have a tough time conceptualizing the fact that you can now, you know, according to the story, you can now print a gun with those 3D printers they have, you know. And there's some arguments about, well, the 3D printers are very expensive, but I just was listening to a news story on the radio the other day, and there are some that you can get for as cheap as $2,500, which, you know, if I'm someone who's trying to go against the authorities and I'm trying to sneak weapons onto a flight, let's say, I don't think $2,500 is going to stop me.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's face it. I don't think Al-Qaeda is going to go out of business because they bought a bunch of 3D scanners. I mean, like,
right.
They can afford that. You know, even the Crips and the Bloods, who might have, you know, issues with finances from now and again, they've got money to buy 3D scanners. I don't think this is the problem.
Are they still around, Alex?
Who?
The Crips and the Bloods.
I don't know. I mean, I assume. Listen, I'm the least gang person of all time. I was in a fraternity
in college.
Those
were the gangs from our youth. I don't know if they're still around.
I was in a fraternity in college. That's about as gang as I get. So, but we do have to move on. So let's get a final word here. What's your sense? Are they gonna renew this law or not?
I think they're going to have to renew it, but I don't know that it's going to happen in a week.
Okay. You know, probably, I don't know, they'll stall and stall and stall until the government shuts down again. Anyway, let's move on to the third story, which is involving celebrity, which is what everyone wants to talk about anyway. This guy constantly in news, as you pointed out right before we went on air, we just talked about him 2-3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
This is another Spike Lee story, so set it up for us.
So Spike Lee was back on Twitter. He likes to be on Twitter. He likes to say a lot of things on Twitter. And apparently a designer called Juan Luis Garcia, who is claiming that he created the designs for the Old Boy poster. That's that new movie, the new Spike Lee movie.
Yeah. It looked good. I saw a little thing for it, but now I read the reviews that say that the movie's terrible and nobody's going to see it.
Yeah, it looked really good, but now I don't want to see it, having sort of read about it. Mr. Garcia is saying that the poster for Old Boy, that it was stolen by an ad agency who was working on the movie. And his claim is that he worked on it for several months, and the ad agency offered him, you know, a really lowball offer to use his materials, and he said no. He turned them down. And then he saw the posters, and they had actually used his ideas. So his way of sort of getting around to it, he said he reached out to the ad agency, and they threatened him with legal action. So he wrote an open letter to Spike Lee saying, hey, these people use my design for your movie, and I'd like it if you can help me get some sort of, you know, to resolve this matter. And Spike Lee kind of went crazy. You know, he's just like, I don't know this guy. You know, why is this guy reaching out to me? I don't owe him anything. And I thought it was a little bit of an overreaction. I'm not exactly sure. I haven't read the open letter, but it didn't appear that the guy was saying, hey, Spike Lee, you owe me money. It seemed like he was just trying to use it to get attention and get his story out there and hopefully name the ad agency into giving
him money. First of all, it raises the question again, like, why are celebrities on Twitter? Because it only ever gets them into trouble. But number two, and we can go back to that question in a second, but number two, why? I mean, I think the guy made the point, and I think it's a good one. Like, Spike Lee is an artist. I mean, certainly, everyone I think who takes film seriously would consider Spike Lee an auteur, an artist of some note. And why is he not trying to back the work of another artist by saying, look, maybe I don't have to pay him, but the ad agency... Like, I'm gonna at least bring this to the attention of the ad agency and say, hey, is this really true what the guy's saying? And if it is, you should take care of him. I
totally agree with you. It could have been a very simple thing. I don't even think he needed to tweet about this. If this guy writes him an open letter, he can just go to the ad agency, say, hey, this guy's writing me a letter. You guys deal with this. If this is your issue, if you really use his idea, you need to pay him. If you didn't use his idea, you need to make that clear. He shouldn't have taken it on himself, because now he's in it, and all of the headlines are like, you know, Spike Lee slams the designer when he wasn't even really involved in the original issue.
Right. So the ad agency, which for all we know might have actually been in the wrong, is going to skip out of this scot-free, and it makes Spike Lee look like the bad guy, which in fact he may not really be, other than for the after-the-fact issue of dealing with this poorly. Right.
Yeah. I'm completely with you on the celebrities leaving Twitter alone, though. I think if you're that big a celebrity, you should just let somebody else tweet for you, or have your lawyer scan all your tweets before you send them out.
But that's a good segue, because you are a celebrity of some note in certain circles, certainly amongst the alumni of the Nigerian Law School.
Right. They love me.
And so here's the question. I mean, your tweet, right? I mean, do you have you had issues with Twitter and tweeting?
You know, I haven't, but I don't use Twitter or social media generally as my way of kind of working out issues. If something is, you know, causing me a lot of consternation or it's some sort of problem, I don't head to Twitter to deal with it. I don't, you know, use Facebook to kind of get with people who piss me off.
So what do? You actually call them up directly and you communicate with them?
I do civilized. I send an email, you know, like a normal person.
But it certainly sounds evolved and mature, which is certainly not, you know, the norm these days.
I feel like it's very easy to take things out of context. And even email, it's very easy to take it out of context. And so when something happens like this, the guy obviously, you know, is writing you an open letter to sort of get a reaction and hopefully to help solve this issue, and then kind of showing your ass, as they would say, by getting crazy and, you know, yelling at him or typing in all caps, like, I don't know this guy. It's almost like he's being defensive, you know. So for me, when something comes up, I have gotten on Facebook a couple of times, things where people sort of want to give their opinion, usually about something political. And I tell them, look, you know, this is Facebook. Come on. If you really want to talk to me, you're my friend. You should feel free to call me or you should email me. And if we're not friends, then this shouldn't bother you.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So, okay, so the takeaway here is Spike Lee should just probably take a break from Twitter for a while.
Yes.
all right. We have to move on. We have a really actually interesting interview. As the listeners of the podcast know, our own Kevin Israel has a segment called Kevin versus the Internet, where Kevin, you know, explains the ways technology is just baffling him and or causing him consternation and angst. What we're going to do tonight, because it's a special holiday episode, is we're going to have an expanded version of Kevin versus the Internet, where Kevin's going to let me participate and ask him questions about his frustrations and irritations. So we're going to turn to that right now with an interview that it's going to be called Kevin versus the Internet plus Alex. This week we have a very interesting combo. Our usual feature is our own Kevin Israel doing Kevin versus the Internet. But this week, because of the nature of the topic Kevin is going to be talking about, he wanted to have someone in as an interviewer, a foil, as it were. So I'm serving that purpose. So this week we're doing an interview combined with Kevin versus the Internet. And so, Kevin, welcome to the podcast, and take it away.
Thanks, Alex. People have been listening the past few weeks know each week I pick out an article that just drives me crazy. And I think I found a really good one. I'm going to try to give it a legal spin. And Alex, I know this is going to strike close to you because you've actually used yours, and you're going to understand what that means in a second. I found a story online. A gentleman from Las Vegas named Mark Parisi is going to be selling one of his testicles for $35,000.
What?
Yes, for $35,000. So he can buy a Nissan 370Z. Now, this strikes close to home to me for three reasons. First of all, I have testicles. So that right there makes it applicable. Second of all, I actually own a Nissan Z, an older one. I have a 1990 300 ZX, which some would argue was the last original Z car. I know you know nothing about cars, but if any of our listeners understand cars, they'll know what I'm talking about.
I know Nissan. I remember when it was still called Datsun.
Yeah, oh, yeah, you do. Yeah, you probably owed money to Mr. Datsun. So that's the second reason that I am a Z car owner. And thirdly, I was a poor law student at one time, and I was desperate for money, and I, you know, was doing comedy and pretty much doing anything to make an extra buck so I could survive. So I know what it's like to be desperate for money. This guy is apparently he's prolific for being cheap. He's been featured on TLC's Extreme Cheapskates, and he's used his body as a human experiment. And he's offered it up to science, and has apparently earned over $150,000 in the past 2 years by being a human guinea pig.
Well, look, let me ask you a question. I have to stop you because I understand that people will sell organs like kidneys because there is a demand for that, and those can be transplanted. But who is buying a testicle?
I don't know. I'm not going to lie. The article I found, which, by the way, I guess I should give a plug to Left Lane News. It's one of my favorite car sites. Didn't actually say, and I was looking for that. I was curious as to what they would do with it. I assume science has, you know, research scientists could probably do a lot with a viable testicle in, you know, probably cancer studies or fertility studies. I don't know.
Because I'm trying to figure it out, you're not going to, a woman is going to want just a testicle without a man wrapped around it. Like, that's not worth 35 grand. And
you know what? Maybe that's the only part of us that is worth anything.
And the other thing is, I don't know that a testicle can be transplanted. Like, if a guy had a problem with his testicles, I don't know that you could get one from someone else and have it transplanted.
I don't know that either. I'm not a surgeon. I just know that for $35,000, listen, and my joke in the beginning, you actually used yours to create a child.
It's true.
With $35,000, would you do it
for a testicle?
Yeah.
No. I'm sorry. Whether you believe in God or not, nature, God, whatever it is, gave you certain body parts. I'm a firm believer in keeping all of them unless it's absolutely necessary to have them removed.
All right, that's fair. I wouldn't do it for $35,000.
What's your price?
I think $200,000.
How'd you come up with that number?
I don't know. It just seems like enough money that could, you know, probably solve some of my problems.
I mean, it's a slippery slope, because what if I said, okay, Kev, look, I got, how about 160?
No, I think I would start at 200. I think my baseline is 200.
Oh, I'm sure you could be negotiated down, because if you have a number, you can be negotiated down.
Maybe 175 and a Nissan 370Z. That's what I But, you know, the interesting thing is apparently this guy loves the 370Z. And what I find odd about this, and this is gonna take you a little out of your comfort zone, but this isn't a great sports car. It's a good sports car. It's not a Porsche. It's not a Ferrari. It's not a Lamborghini. It's a everyman sports car. $35,000 isn't an unattainable price for the average guy to get a sports car. This guy's really selling himself short. I mean, he's giving up.
In more ways than one, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I would, you know, I'd hold out for, you know, maybe a Porsche 911, not necessarily turbo, maybe just the base Porsche 911. That's about an $85,000-$90,000 car.
Well, let me ask you this. What's the blue book value of the Nissan 370 he's buying?
It's $35,000. That's not true. The base price of the very base model, the very bottom floor model, is $29,990.
So one testicle gets you a tricked out 370.
Yeah, it gets you the mid level. The top level convertible goes up to $41,000. So he's not even getting the top model of this car.
Now, what happens with the Kelly? I know a little bit about cars. So what happens? What has Kelly value? Like, what's the depreciation rate on one of these things?
Well, oddly, if you really want to get overly technical, I know about these cars. And the 370Z has not been the great seller for Nissan, and their depreciation is considerable. So that's another very good point. He's giving up one of his balls for a car that's not even going to hold its value.
Well, that was the point I'm trying to drive at. And how old is this guy?
It doesn't say, but he looks to be in his 50s, probably. His early 50s.
All right, well, that's fair then, because I was going to say, look, if he's in his 20s or his 30s, a 20-year-old or 30-year-old man's testicles are worth more than a depreciating 370. They might be worth like a Porsche, like you say, something that'll hold its value. If he's in his 50s, his testicles, they've done the work they're going to do, more or less.
So are you saying that Kelly Blue Book should value testicles too?
No, I'm saying that if you're in your 50s, the great likelihood is that your testicles also have depreciated in value to some degree and are also going to get a lot less use, whereas, you know.
Well, functional use anyway.
Functional use, sorry. And if you're in your 20s or your 30s, they still have a long life ahead of them. So I'm saying that, you know, if now in his 50s, if he's giving it up for a Nissan 370, okay, I could see that because his testicles and the car will probably depreciate at roughly the same rate. If he was in his 20s and he was buying the Nissan, I'd be like, no, you should hold out for like a 70 grand Porsche, right?
Right. Now, and here's another important point I'd like to make about this man giving up his testicles. It used to be thought that the testicles just produce sperm, which obviously if you're in your 50s and you're done having children, they're not as essential. But the testicles are also involved with testosterone production, which, as you know, being an older man, that starts to decrease after a period.
I wouldn't know, although I do say
you want
that.
To hold on to that as long as possible, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, I'm still hung up on the fact that, like, well, whatever. I will get graphic for the listening audience.
Alex, low T is nothing to be ashamed of. There's a gel that you can rub on any part of your body.
Well, that's what the guy's thinking. He's thinking, forget it. I'll sell my other testicle and I'll get some low T gel.
But to wrap this back around to comedians at law and lawyers, yeah. we have a lot of law students who listen to us, and I'm sure you guys are all, you know, desperate for money. You're desperate for a lot of things at this point. But law school's expensive. There's a lot of debt involved. Would you guys out there sell your testicle for money? You know, maybe to alleviate some of your debt, maybe to, you know, cover your books for a few semesters. $35,000 would obviously cover more than a few semesters, but right. You know, that's a lot of money. And I got to tell you, when I was in law school, it got really tight at points where, you know, I might have thought about that.
That's interesting. That's a good thing to have people contact us about. Frankly, me, I would my answer is no. I'm not even sure I would have my wisdom teeth pulled for like a bicycle.
All right. Well, okay. So clearly you're not the bravest person in the world to be.
No, because I believe that, like, my dentist, when I was a million years ago, when I was a teenager, my dentist wanted me to have my wisdom teeth pulled. He said, they're coming in crooked. You're going to have a problem. And I said, well, I don't have a problem right now. Nothing hurts. I'm not going to do it. Well, here I am. I think it's literally 32 years later, and they've never given me a bit of problems, never had any kind of, you know, dental issues because of my wisdom teeth. So
start following now, folks. Alex Barnett is about to have some serious problems with his wisdom teeth, and we're gonna live blog his wisdom teeth extraction process.
All right. Well, look, let's wrap up here. Let's give people a takeaway, Kev. This is your segment.
So the takeaway is, listen, this guy's crazy. Again, is Mark Parisi. You can find the story on leftlanenews.com. Would you guys do it? Would you sell a testicle for money? And if so, what's your bottom line? I said mine's $200,000. So what's yours? Tweet at us at Comedians at Law with the hashtag CalPod. And if you make me laugh, if it's something good, I'll send you a T-shirt.
Great. All right. Well, now we're back to the podcast. Okay, well, that was an interesting interview, no doubt. Hopefully people learned something from that. And now we turn to our last segment, Ndidi, which is where we turn to our Twitter feed, to look at what people, our fans, our listeners, are doing by way of engaging with us. And I'm looking at the Twitter feed, and what the good news is, here's the good news. The good news is we have a lot of new followers. We've got eight new followers in like the last 2 days, which is fantastic. I mean, it's not Miley Cyrus or Nicki Minaj level, but for a group of former lawyers turned comedian, I think it's pretty impressive.
I agree.
Yeah, I think it's actually pretty impressive, and it looks like, let's see, I was gonna be very excited. It looked like one of them was actually a member of a minority group, but alas, no, it looks like it's all white people.
Not me.
No. I'm saying the people following us. No, you are.
I know.
No, the great truth is that of the Comedians Law, we're all minorities except for a few of us, because there's a lot of Jewish people in the group, and one black person, and well. Actually, no, we do have a minority follower, thank goodness. So somebody who is a, looks like African-American and an LGBT equality advocate, which, so thank
nice.
You. To, yeah, at Rodney Kendall 1. Thank you, Rodney, for following us.
Hey, Rodney.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we're all about diversity and celebrating diversity and the growth of the population of women and minority groups in the law. But... we're supposed to be funny here, so let's talk about what else is funny in our feed. And what's funny in our feed is that nobody is sending us tweets. I mean, they're favoring us, and they're following us, and they're retweeting us even sometimes, although mostly it's our own Joan Weisblatt retweeting and favoring a lot of our tweets.
I think our little guy in our logo is intimidating, you know, with his red tie and his, like, his black, his face is black, his clothes are black, his briefcase is black. He seems very intimidating. I think if we had a softer guy or lady in our logo, that would bring people in.
Maybe we'll get a Marilyn Monroe thing going on. That would get
bugged. That's a great idea.
But actually, I spoke too soon because we actually do have a couple of tweets at us. One of our fans, Mr. Bernard, who's been following us for quite some time, he tweeted to us. He wanted to know where one of our former members was, and I had to just write to him and say that the gentleman has gone on to pursue some individual pursuits. But hopefully, Mr. Bernard, you'll at Adjective Maker, you'll be listening still with us. And then it looks
don't
like
leave us, Mr. Bernard.
Yeah, and then only Io, who is a self-proclaimed Jesus freak, SHSU alum. Just tweeted to us that she go back that presupposes presupposes I left. I don't know what that means exactly. She was responding to a tweet from us, but I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I think I think she's trying to say she never left.
She never left. Okay.
Right, I think.
All right. Well, look, we need a Twitter challenge for next week. So, indeed, I'm gonna leave the it's ladies' privilege this week. We need to have somebody. We have to have people tweet to us. So give them a good challenge. What are they gonna tweet to us?
I want to hear what folks think, especially if there's any IP lawyers out there or litigators about this strategy of tweeting or sending an open letter to a celebrity when you have some sort of beef with, you know, a third party. What do you guys think about what Juan Luis Garcia did, and who do you think is in the right? Do you think Spike Lee dealt with it appropriately, or do you think he should have dealt with it in a different way, or maybe not dealt with it at all?
Okay.
Tweet us at Comedians at Law.
I like that. I like that. That's a good Twitter. That's a good tweet challenge. All right, everybody, for NDD Origi and myself, Alex Barnett, that has been the Comedians Law Podcast, episode 62. We will talk to you next week.
Bye.